This talk is brought to you by FOCUS, the Fellowship of Catholic University Students.
Astrophysics and Creation by Father Robert Spitzer.
Hello, my name is Autumn Fisk, and I'm a missionary at the University of Northern Colorado. And I'm very excited to be introducing you to Father Spitzer. He will be presenting you Astrophysics and Creation. Father Spitzer is currently the president of the Magis Center of Faith and Reason and the Spitzer Center of Ethical Leadership. The former is dedicated to showing the close connection between faith and reason in contemporary astrophysics, philosophy, and historical study of the New Testament. The latter is dedicated to personal and cultural transformation that supports principle-based ethics and leads to noble and enduring success. Please help me in welcoming Father Spitzer.
Thank you, Autumn. Well, it's a true honor to be with all of you. And just being at the confessions last night and to join you for those evening sessions was very, very edifying indeed. You certainly give me great hope for the future of the church and for the activity of the Holy Spirit in evangelization. You really are just true edifying examples. My objective today is to take a look at the consistency between faith and science, specifically between faith and astrophysics, and to look very specifically at the origins of the universe and the intelligent design of the universe, but not so much from the vantage point of biology, but from the vantage point of astrophysics. I want to begin with just three quick clarifications, though. The first clarification is that I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm a philosopher of science who studied a lot of astrophysics and is looking at the relationship between astrophysics and philosophy, metaphysics, and even transcendent creation. So that's what I do, and that's what my scholarly work is on. The second thing is just to give you a sense of what science can and can't do. Science is always going to be open to further discovery and further inquiry. So the key thing is, even in the most elaborate physical theories, something new could be discovered. And if something new is discovered, then it could cause a modification of the theory as we've already known it. So the key thing that I just want to talk about right now is, well, can science tell us anything about the transcendent? Is everything always subject to modification? And the thought is, yes, everything is subject to modification if new discoveries are made. But science can also tell us about a convergence of evidence. Science can start putting together diverse pieces of evidence which all are like puzzle pieces that add up to a single puzzle. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. I want to talk about three different clues that all add up, three puzzle pieces that sort of join forces with one another. They could be subject to modification. There could be some naturalistic explanation, which would have to be very, very extravagant, but nevertheless, there could be some, you know, naturalistic explanations we'll talk about. But if you start assembling all of the pieces, you get what John Henry Newman called the illative sense. What he meant by the illative sense is that you don't rest the rational grounding of your faith on one piece of evidence. You rest it on the propensity that is given you by tons of evidence. So, for example, you can get philosophical proofs for the existence of God. And I've just written about three new ones in my new book, New Proofs for the Existence of God. You can get this very highly deductive. And that's part of the equation. But in astrophysics, you also get three unbelievable pieces of that puzzle, too. And they're all pointing in the same direction, toward a creator, not just toward any creator, but a super intelligent, super calculating creator. They're pointing in that direction. Any one of those pieces of evidence could, of course, be subject to modification. But if you put them all together, there is a strong probative force, a strong sense of where the evidence is pointing that leads us to what Newman would have called a grammar of assent. John Henry Cardinal Newman, one of the great theologians of the church, has said, after a while, the evidence is so overwhelming, not just from one, but from multiple sources, that one ascends to faith with reason, responsibility, and knows quite simply that God has planted these clues in our midst just for our edification. Let me try and explain. What are the three clues? And I'm going to just describe the universe very basically right after this. The three clues are these. Number one, what's called the advent of a singularity in what's called general relativity theory. I'll explain it in a moment. Second clue, low entropy universe. You need a low entropy universe in order to have any life form, trust me. But it is really against the odds to get a low entropy universe. Third thing that you need what's called anthropic coincidences. You need the cosmological constants to be at particular levels where they can actually not generate a chaotic universe. It's these three clues, when you begin to assemble them all, the multiplicity of the clues, there's so many of them, within each of these categories, that's when you begin to see the fullness of God's creative and revealing hand to us through astrophysics and, well, we're not going to discuss it today, through philosophy. But let's just stick with this for a moment. What's our universe like? You may have learned when you were little kids that the universe was infinite in extent and infinite in time and infinite in mass points, and that there was an infinite number of aggregations of mass points for an infinite amount of time, so that nothing in the whole wide world is improbable. That was the universe of Dr. Newton. Sir Isaac Newton, brilliant man, but incorrect. The universe, just to give you a sense of what it's like, the observable universe that we now know of is 13.7 billion light years in radius, plus or minus 100 million light years, approximately. It has 10 to the 80th baryons worth of energy. A baryon is kind of the protoparticle that gives rise to protons and all of the assembly of protons and electrons and neutrons, you know, that give rise to mass and mass energy in the universe. So 10 to the 80th baryons worth of regular energy in the universe. There's probably about two times as much dark energy out there. That's energy that acts inversely with the gravitational force, or with the gravitational field. And then, of course, you have a universe, observable universe, that's approximately 13.7 billion years old, plus or minus 100 million years. There are four forces in that universe. There's a strong nuclear force, which binds protons together in the nucleus of the atom. The weak force, which does a whole variety of things, including keeping matter and antimatter collisions from happening and so forth. There's electromagnetic forces, which of course create all the electromagnetic bondings of all of our elements. And there's the gravitational force. The interaction of these four forces leads to just about everything that you see that's physical, not human freedom, not acts of the soul, not rational choices, but everything that you see that's physical out there. So that's basically the universe in a nutshell. Now, you look at that and you go, well, is there really, can science, you know, give us some clue then? It can't give us a proof, right? Because things are subject to modifications in science. Always the possibility of new discoveries. Always the possibility that you could get a naturalistic explanation. But does science give us a clue about whether or not the universe began, you know, had a beginning in time, and whether or not the universe was created by something that was super intelligent? And there are three major sets of clues that have been elucidated by a whole set of very, very well-known physicists. Fred Hoyle, Roger Penrose, Paul Davies, Brandon Carter, John Polkinghorne. There's a lot of people who have been working on these things for a long, long time. Let me give you the first set of clues. Singularity. Right now, we live in what's called a GTR universe, a general theory of relativity universe. What's a GTR universe? It's a universe that has space and time. It's a universe which is bigger than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. You can't get it smaller than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, because if you do, you will slip literally into the space-time continuum. You don't want to do that. And by the way, you're in quantum cosmology. But the space-time universe that we know of, this general theory of relativity universe that we know of, that universe now looks like it began with a singularity. Now, what is a singularity? A singularity is a point at which all space-time comes to a point. That space-time which comes to a point, imagine like almost a dimensionless point, and then, boom, everything emerges out of that dimensionless point. That space-time point, that dimensionless point, really constitutes the boundary to past time in our GTR universe. It's a boundary to time. You can't go, the GTR universe can't proceed beyond that, back further than that. Now, if you take a look at that for just 2 seconds, then what you want to see is, well, is there any evidence from science that would establish, demonstrate that such a singularity, such a beginning of past time for our GTR universe actually existed? And the answer is, yes, there is. The first singularity was discovered by Hawking and Penrose. Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, Hawking-Penrose singularity. And that was discovered way back in the 80s. And in that particular discovery, one of the conditions of the demonstrable proof that they made was that the universe wasn't inflationary. Today we think that there was an inflationary period in the universe. So it looked for a while there that maybe the universe didn't begin with the singularity, because one of the conditions of the proof had been violated. But in point of fact, these three guys came along, Arvind Borda, an Indian guy, and Alexander Vilenkin, a Russian, and Alan Guth, an American physicist, came along and actually showed in a very important article in 2003, Physical Review Letters, this is a very important physics journal, actually demonstrated the following. Every single universe, inflationary model universe. So remember, inflation was the reason that the singularity theories of Hawking and Penrose were violated. But now, every single inflationary model universe with a Hubble expansion greater than zero, which all of them have because they're inflationary, has to have a singularity, has to have a beginning in finite proper time. Means that the universe couldn't be infinite. Means that there has to be some beginning of the GTR universe. Now, as with all science, you can find an explanation for this. And of course, or try to find an alternative to this. And perhaps that singularity is not the beginning of time itself, but the beginning of another very unusual era called a quantum cosmological era, where there wasn't space-time as we know it, where there wasn't a general theory of relativity, where gravity was not explained by space-time. But this would have been an era in which the universe was less than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So it would have been when the universe is really, really tiny and presumably not too old. But the key thought, of course, is the following. There could be this previous era where gravity is strongly interacting with the other three cosmic forces, the strong nuclear force, the weak force, and the electromagnetic forces, that they're strongly interacting in something that's not like the space-time theory, not like the general theory of relativity at all. And so physicists gave rise to what's called a string theory and also quantum cosmology. There was the Hartle-Hawking solution, the Hawking-no-boundary solution. Then there's the string, the first theoretical string explanations. Then M theory, which was 11-dimensional string theory, and so forth and so on. So perhaps that era did not have a beginning, even though our GTR universe had a beginning, but this little microscopic era, it had been around for a long, long time. There are three things, though, that you have to see that are going on with quantum cosmology today. First, time is asymmetrical. That means it only goes in one direction. It can't be going backward and forward and backward and forward in this cosmological state. Roger Penrose established this way back in 1989, that quantum cosmology is basically time asymmetrical, has a unidirectionality of time. Second thing, every quantum cosmological solution that has been derived that's non-string theory has wound up with singularities. Indeed, multiple singularities. So the singularity is still inescapable. Thirdly, the string theory explanations for all of this have now gotten to the point of absolute... In order to avoid singularities in string theory, so you're trying to make a non-singular theory and to create a supersymmetry of all the strings, in order to do this right now, you've got all the best minds in physics trying to avoid the singularity like mad in these supersymmetries with multiple dimensions. And as one physicist put it to me the other day, Spencer, the equations are so complicated, they can only be solved by God. And that's literally where we are. Now, is there a chance that there might be a smoothed out superstring, perfect symmetry that doesn't require get into a singularity? Yes. Do I really think this is going to happen? No. I do not. Because, of course, whenever things in science get convoluted beyond, right, you give up elegance and you start just postulating, you know, super dimensions and so forth and so on, in order to make these things occur, the main thing you have to realize at that point is it's probably unlikely that we're going to avoid a singularity, even in supersymmetries, even in string theory, even in quantum cosmology, and certainly you can't avoid a singularity in the GTR universe. What does that mean? That's a big clue. That's a clue that there is a high likelihood, or at least there's very, very good reason for you to believe that it is reasonable and responsible from a scientific point of view to postulate a creation event somewhere before 13.7 billion years ago, but not too much thereafter or there before. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you have a real singularity, I mean, of the whole universe, no other eras permitted, basically everything winds up with a singularity at the end of the day, everything winds up pointing to a beginning, that means that the universe at some point did not exist. Now, if the universe did not exist at some point, whether it's at the point where the GTR universe came into being or whether it's at the point where a supersymmetry quantum cosmological universe came into being, if the universe did not exist at that point, okay, everybody, then it was nothing. And from nothing, nothing comes. There's no such thing as nothing. Don't make something out of nothing. There's really nothing is nothing. There's no such thing as it. And therefore, if the universe was nothing, everybody, it did not create itself. Because from nothing, nothing comes. Which means what? something else? Some other force transcending universal space-time asymmetry? Something out there which transcends the universe itself and the universe's space and time had to do it, because the universe could not do it for itself. That's a clue. Is it subject to modification? Could be. Could there be some supersymmetry string solution? Maybe. But right now, it really doesn't look like it. So fit that into the puzzle for a second. So that's a jigsaw piece. Are you guys overwhelmed? Just put the jigsaw piece or a puzzle piece right up there. And now let's go to a second clue. They all kind of rhyme together. The second clue concerns low entropy. What low entropy, you know what the second law of thermodynamics means, right? That, you know, the law of entropy essentially means that we're using up all of our free energy, which is available to do work. As each energetic reaction occurs, there's always a slight loss of free energy that would be able to do work in the future. So the first clue that we get from entropy, or the second law of thermodynamics, is time really probably couldn't be infinite. Now, of course, I have to say really probably, because I'm dealing with science. I'm not dealing with the deductive proof and logic, which can establish with certitude that God exists. I'm just dealing with entropy. But you see, if the universe had been around for an infinite amount of time, it would be thermodynamically dead. There'd be no free energy in it. No free energy, no work's going to get done. No work's going to get done. It's going to be really cold out there, 0 degrees Kelvin, bad. Very bad. But we're not there. And the point then means what? I don't think the universe... So somebody says, wait a minute. Maybe entropy doesn't happen in strings. Yeah, it does. Jacob Bekenstein. Okay. Then, well, maybe entropy doesn't happen in black holes. Yeah, it does. Jacob Bekenstein again. Equations. Big time equations. So, okay. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some state we can find where entropy really doesn't hold in the universe. But once again, there really isn't any that we see. And every attempt thus far just keeps... By the way, the entropy inside a black hole is much higher than the entropy out here. We don't have a dead universe. That's a clue. The universe hasn't been around for an infinite amount of time. But then a much more astounding clue comes from one of the 10 greatest physicists that I know of. And that's Roger Penrose. And in a book called The Emperor's New Mind, Penrose tries to figure out what the odds of getting a low entropy universe out of our Big Bang would be. Now, of course, you want a low entropy universe, trust me on this. If you have a high entropy universe, then all the free energy gets used up real fast. And if it gets used up real fast, then you're not going to have a lot of work, not a lot of sustaining of life, not even the conditions necessary to bring a life form about, not even the conditions necessary, frankly, for any evolutionary process of any kind, stellar evolution or otherwise, because the universe will die too quickly. Now, here's the astounding thing. You can actually figure out what the total entropy of our universe is. All you need to know is what's called the exponential of the phase space of the universe. But take it from me and Penrose. The total amount of universes, phase space predicts how many universes could have come out. Low entropy ones, high entropy ones, etc. The total number of universes that you're going to get out of our 10 to the 80th baryons is 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1. That's a double exponent. That's a big number. So that's a 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123. That's like a 10 and then in the exponent, a 1 with 123 zeros after it. So the exponent is a trillion, 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 trillion. In the exponent. Now, if you try to write that number out, I'm not kidding you, and you try to put it in ordinary notation and make every zero about 8-point type, the universe will barely be able to hold this number. It's a biggie. Now, that's the total number of universes that could have come out of 10 to the 80th baryons. Now, how many of them are low-entropy ones? Only 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 80th. Now, you say that's a huge number, Spencer, because you've got 80 zeros instead of 123 zeros in the second, in the exponent. You know, that's still, it's nothing. 10 to the 10 to the 123 is so much larger than 10 to the 10 to the 80th that when you divide 10 to the 10 to the 123 by 10 to the 10 to the 80th, it barely affects the number at all. That means that the odds against a low entropy universe, the kind you need to have a life form, the kind you need to sustain any biological process, the kind you need to sustain any scheme of recurrence in biology or chemistry, the kind you need in order to have an orderly immersion of the universe from the Big Bang, the kind you absolutely need so that the universe doesn't burn itself out and die before it can do anything, the odds against it are 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1. You guys, if you believe that this occurred by pure chance, I have a bridge to sell you. What basically, Roger Penrose, he looks at this number, right? This is the physicist who discovered it. He looks at the number, and you know what he calls the agency which produced this selection of this exceedingly, exceedingly improbable low-entropy universe emerging out of our Big Bang by pure chance? You know what he calls it? The Creator. The physicist literally comes out of the closet and calls the agency, the Creator. And not only does he call it the Creator, he calls it the Creator multiple times. And he says that it is such a small amount of the total phase space that will lead to this low entropy universe. You know, he puts this diagram in it, and it's just imagine this for a second, that you have a dartboard that is the size of 2 Milky Ways. You know, that's big. And that you want to hit that proton over there. And you are now going to start throwing the dart. Okay. It's going to take you a long time to hit that proton. The odds are so enormous against a low entropy universe that Penrose says, you know, he calls it the Creator. I mean, let me liken it to, if you like literature, a good Shakespearean image. You say to the monkey sternly, "Type out the works of Shakespeare. I will be back in 2 weeks." The monkey begins immediately typing on the typewriter. And of course, after his random tapping, you come back into the room in 2 weeks. Macbeth, perfect. Hamlet, perfect. You say, "Something happened." Well, you get a choice, everyone. You can choose to believe, hey, somebody came into the room and helped that monkey who had a really good knowledge of Shakespeare. Or you can still proceed to believe, even though the odds are absolutely astoundingly astronomical against it, well, I guess he did it by a pure random chance. I didn't see the guy who helped him. It comes to a matter of belief, as in all things in science. Once again, we see that you have, you know, God always gives us a way out. He's not going to force you to believe, But he's going to give you a monster clue. 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1, the Penrose number. That's a monster clue. He's going to give you another monster clue. Hey, we're not a dead universe yet. How could we have been around for an infinite amount of time? Particularly if there is entropy in black holes and there's entropy in supersymmetrical systems. Okay. Singularities. Clues. Clues. That's another piece. Just put it there, the low entropy piece. Put it in your puzzle. Could there be a natural explanation that could come out for this selection later on? Sure. We haven't been able to identify anything remotely close to it. No constant to be associated. No clue for a constant, but who knows? Maybe so, maybe so. Odds are not there, but there's your puzzle piece. The illative sense. Keep converging. Third puzzle piece. Think for a second. Oh, everybody, I better explain what a cosmological constant is. The third puzzle piece comes from cosmological constants. And a cosmological constant is a number which controls all of the equations of physics. So it's a number. Planck's constant. Or everybody knows the speed of light constant, 300,000 kilometers per second or 186,200 miles per second. There's the weak force constant. There's the strong force. There's a constant associated with the four universal forces. There's the mass of the electron, the mass of the proton, the charge of the electron proton, et cetera, right? So you've got these 17 constants out there. You have 17 numbers that are all regulating all of the relationships between space-time and the four groups of energy and the universe as a whole. 17 numbers which do all of these things. They're regulating them all. And one thing we know is, thank God for two things. Number one, that there are constants. And number two, that they are what they are. Now, I just want to give you a sense. If you didn't have constants, in other words, if these numbers were not the same yesterday and today, 1,000 years ago and today, out there in the 13.7 billion light years from now, or from here, et cetera, et cetera. The key thing to remember is if those constants aren't the same, we're going to have a chaotic universe. If you have a chaotic universe, you're not going to have things sustained. If numbers are changing, these numbers that control all the equations of physics are changing, then you're not going to have an orderly universe. You're not going to be able to have an evolutionary process. You're not going to be able to have a development of life. You're not going to have any stellar evolution, anything, nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing. So you're really lucky that we have 17 constants. And you say, but why? Out of the chaos of the Big Bang, why should there be any constants? A clue. Because there is no natural explanation for why there are constants. But there are, and it's really good. Number two, there are also constants that have the precise values that they need to have in order to give rise to an anthropic universe. What's an anthropic universe? A universe that'll sustain a life form. Any kind of a life form. And what I want to propose to you is that if these constants are off by just barely, you know, any realistic amount compared to the other constants in relation to all the other constants, if they're off just by a shade, you've got a real problem. Because the universe will be non-anthropic and it will not be able to sustain any life form. Let's take an example, several examples. Let's take the weak force constant in relation to the gravitational force constant. If the weak force constant is off by one part in 10 to the 50th, this is a big number, which is a small fraction. It's 10 to the 50th is 50 in the exponent, right? So that's 50 zeros, and then one part in 10 to the 50th. By one part in 10 to the 50th in one direction, the universe will just collapse into a black hole and that'll be the end of it. Very bad for life forms. Very bad. Second thing, If the universe is off by one part in 10 to the 50th in the other direction from his current value, this is like microscopic little touch. The universe will expand so rapidly there will be no clusters of gases, no clusters of gases, no galactic systems, no galactic systems, no galaxies. No galaxies, no stars, trees or birdies or anything. You need aggregation of particles in order to have a life form. No aggregation, it's all over. Guys with me? We're really lucky that the weak force constant is what it is and it's not off by one part in 10 to the 50th. Thank you. Now, you can believe that this occurred by pure chance. You really could. But I'll get to the mini-universes theory in a moment. Second thing, just another example. If the strong force constant, that's the one that binds the protons together in the nucleus of an atom, if the strong force constant is off by merely 2% in one direction, you will have no hydrogen. Very bad for life forms. And if you have it off by 2% in the other direction, you will have no elements heavier than hydrogen. Very bad for a life form, since carbon is one of those elements. In short, we're really lucky this strong force is what it is. Let me give you another one. You know, I mean, but you can. It could have happened by pure chance. Okay, with you. Okay. The third thing is, this converted, by the way, one of the greatest atheists who was in the domain of physics who ever lived, Fred Hoyle. Fred Hoyle, you know, he was everywhere to be found. If there was a theory of God or a theory of creation or a theory of a singularity, Hoyle was out there trying to find an alternative to it because he was really a very, very adamant atheist. One day, his partner, William Fowler, called him into his office and he said, well, I just figured out, you know, the numeric coefficients that are required to bring together the carbon atom. In other words, the carbon atom's bonding properties, which lead to all the life forms that we know of coming from our periodic table. And so he looked at the resonance structures, and he looked at them in comparison with beryllium and oxygen. And those resonance structures have to be very, very precise. In fact, so precise that Fowler, you know, the numbers were just, you know, they're like Penrose numbers, right? There's huge, huge numbers. You know, that would be the odds against the resonance structures being correct. If the resonance structure, by the way, isn't correct, it'd be like shattering glass with a high, you know, soprano singing and just shattering the glass. The vibrations, right, would not be sympathetic vibrations and the bonding properties could not occur. Well, Hoyle looked at this, and the rumor is Hoyle went back to his office for 3 days. And he was shattered, as it were. And he came out of the office, and this is what he said. There are no blind forces worth speaking of. I think you will agree, he said. I think you will agree that there is some super-calculating super-intellect that has monkeyed with the constants and equations of physics. So much so that it is almost, that the almost impossible has occurred, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking of. This was a pronouncement about God. Hoyle converted on one clue, on one anthropic coincidence, just turned around from a lifetime of atheism and just said, I can't take any more. Just put those clues of those anthropic queens, that's another little puzzle piece, and put it in with your illative sense. Now, let's just give, you know, there is an alternate naturalistic theory that is out there to explain how it is possible that we could have the universe that we currently know of. In other words, an anthropic universe, low entropy, etc. And that's called the multiple universe theory. In this theory, zillions and zillions and zillions of universes are postulated in order to have pure chance occurrences finally produce a universe as hyper unusual as ours toward an anthropic condition. So in other words, You just keep proliferating 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1 universe, or not to 1, but universes. And you just keep postulating more for each anthropic coincidence. Postulate some more and just keep postulating some more so you get oxygen and beryllium and carbon resonances all happening by pure chance. Postulate some more. In fact, postulate a virtual infinity of universes. And indeed, that is what has been done. It's called the weak anthropic principle. And those universes have been postulated for a long, long time. What's the problem? Well, there's two problems. Number one, there's no one scintilla of evidence for any of them. And they're very difficult to empirically verify since they're other universes. So supernaturalism... And what I mean by, get it, super excessive naturalism, which is very close to supernaturalism, really is also a leap of belief. And Paul Davies just outright calls it that. He says, if you're going to believe in the multiple universe theory, where there's gazillions of universes that are going to be, you know, hypothetically postulated in order to explain a pure chance occurrence for our highly, highly, highly improbable, you know, anthropic universe, it takes as much belief to believe in that as it does to believe in a supernatural creator. In fact, it is just as reasonable and responsible to believe in a supernatural creator as to believe in the super excessive number of universes that have to be postulated in order to get a pure chance occurrence of this anthropic one. It's a clue. But you can always choose to believe in a zillion, 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 10 to the minus 10, 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1 universe. You can always choose to believe that because it is science. And you always have a horizon of new discovery. But now I just want to take you back to the illative sense for a second. Back to where we are. When you take the singularity theories that mean that there has to be a beginning to our GTR universe. Seems to be what's being demonstrated by Borda, Guth, and Willenken. When you take the fact that there is presently no real horizon for getting to a quantum cosmological solution, a prior era, without a singularity or without supersymmetries that require God to resolve the equation. It's a clue. When you get to entropy and you see that the universe is not yet dead, and it ought to be if it was around for an infinite amount of time, when you get to the low entropy universe and the fact that it's a 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1, even if there might be a naturalistic solution, but there just doesn't seem to be one. When you take that and you combine it up with all of the other anthropic coincidences, and I mentioned just a few, and the fact that there's any constants at all, why should there be? That's just a naturalism. Why would you have constants? It all seems to add up to a monstrous clue. A clue which is verified by the proofs from philosophy, the new proofs from the philosophy of mathematics. It adds up to at least a monstrous clue that naturalism is inadequate. That is to say, solutions that seek only from within the physical universe alone seem to be inadequate to the solution. It seems to be a monstrous clue to some kind of transcendent, intelligent, supercalculating agency outside of our universe. It seems to be adding up to a clue, something that we know of from our hearts, something that we know of from our spiritual lives. It all combines in one massive illative sense where Newman says there comes a point at which the evidence is so overwhelming from so many different spheres of science, philosophy, astrophysics, spirituality, the historicity of the resurrection, etc., that one finally is swept into a grammar of assent. One is simply swept into the yes of the overabundance of clues. But God is not going to force your hand. God is not going to compel you into it. You'll always be free to believe in a multiplicity of, in virtual infinity of universes. You will always be free to believe that all of the philosophical proofs have some logical flaw, which I can't find them, but maybe they're there. But the point is, for those who have eyes to see, the evidence, the reasonable, responsible, and rational evidence is very overwhelming from astrophysics, from philosophy, from within astrophysics itself to be swept up into the grammar of assent, assent to God. And that basically is my thesis for the day. Thanks very, very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much. We have time for a couple questions, sir. Yes? No? Yes. Good. I have, if you haven't noticed, a slight visual defect, so if you wouldn't mind shouting your question out, I would appreciate it. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. The question was, can I speak briefly about what I think as both a priest and someone who's knowledgeable about science, about the origins of life on Earth? I think you're talking about life or intelligent life like us. Okay. With respect to life, I do think you have certain unanswered questions that maybe there is a natural solution, maybe there isn't. I don't know yet. But I know one thing, there are a whole set of remarkable schemes of recurrence that require a whole lot of programming in order to occur. Now, I look at it from the vantage point of physics up to biology, so I'm not just looking at, life is caused by protoplasm. Whoa, what's that? You know, that is a complex set of interacting, intelligible relations among physical forces that it just requires enormous complexing, enormous, states of process and schemes of recurrence. And those things, of course, do I think that they happen by pure chance? No. I basically think that the programming requirements to develop the laws of biology from the laws of chemistry and the laws of chemistry from the laws of physics are so enormous, right, that I really do think that it does require, again, an agency. In today's talk, I only talked about, right, getting to a universe which could sustain life. But, of course, there are all the further questions of, well, wait a minute, what about getting to DNA and RNA? One of the most complex, in my view, you can analogize it to a computer program very easily with, DNA structures being like hardware and the programming of DNA being like software and trying to look at this from that vantage point. But the key thing is, do I think this happened by pure chance? No, I do not. I don't believe it. Can I prove it? No, but I think it's, again, one of those anthropic coincidences. Do I believe, for example, that a human being emerged from a non-self-conscious, non-reflective being that had no sense of the transcendentals, like an ape, by pure chance? No, I do not. Do I believe that human beings have to be special creators, as it were, the creation of a soul, in addition to whatever biological bodies we have? Yes, I do. I mean, frankly, if you've ever read Gödel's theorem, Kurt Gödel wrote a theorem about the difference between human intelligence and machine intelligence. And machine intelligence is basically reducible to bits and bytes. But the key thought is, with machine intelligence, machines do not self-correct their flaws in their former sets of algorithms They don't do that by an intentional move beyond the algorithms to set up a whole new mathematical system. All machine intelligence works from the algorithms that have been given to it, and it has to correct from within the algorithms themselves. Humans have never done this over the course of history. How do we do this? I don't know if it's a material agency, but I seriously doubt it. The other thing is, you have these weird capacities for what are called the transcendentals. So you have a desire for perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. Try and describe those in algorithmically finite structures of physics. Really hard. Let's take, perfect truth. I have a desire for perfect truth. In fact, my little nieces have a desire for perfect truth. They walk up to me and they go, Uncle Bobby, well, why is this? I say, oh, because of this. Why is that? Because of that. Why is that? Finally, I have to go time out because we're in the deepest modes of quantum theory. How did we get there? We got there because, like little Exocet missiles, they knew that I had not given them a completely intelligible answer. And so they just kept and will keep asking questions. And the point is, how do they know that they haven't gotten to complete intelligibility? Why is it, by the way, with respect to love, why is it you wreck your perfectly good love relationships with one another by expecting people to be perfect love, perfect understanding, perfect relatability, perfect home, and perfect meaning in life for you, and you're going to do the same for them? Where, and of course, then they disappoint you, and they act like finite, imperfect human beings that don't understand you perfectly, and you get disappointed. Well, Plato says, skip the fact that you wreck all these good love relationships by expecting perfection. Where did you ever get the desire for perfect love in the first place so that you could try and wish it out of a poor, finite, and imperfect human being? And while we're at it, where in the world did we ever get the desire for perfect justice or fairness? Where you actually sit there and you just desire perfect justice or fairness, so much so that you have dashed idealists and so forth. Well, you guys, I'll tell you, you're strange. You have capacities that are not yet describable and probably will never be describable through the algorithmically finite structures of physics. And that ought to give you pause, because it is very likely that you have a soul, a self-conscious soul. And do I think you got that without an intentional creation of God? But then again, science, I'm just kidding. No, I think honestly, science will never be able to prove that one. And so I think it's quite beyond the bounds of science because you're in the domain of metaphysics. Anyway, I think I might have worn out my welcome here. And so thank you very, very much. Appreciate your time. Yeah.
This talk was brought to you by FOCUS, the Fellowship of Catholic University Students. If you would like to listen to more talks, please visit us at www.focusequip.org.